Mama Kay stood on a landing overlooking the warehouse floor. Agon's dogs, as they'd taken to calling themselves, were training under his watchful eye. The force had shrunk to 100 men, and Mama Kay was sure that by now its existence was well known.
Do you think they're ready?
More training would make them better. Battle will make them better faster. But it will cost lives.
And your witch hunters?
They're no Yamori. Yamori can riddle a man with arrows from 100 paces while galloping away from him. The best I can hope for is 10 men who will get in range, stop, shoot, and move on before the fireballs get to them. My hunters aren't worthy of the bows they carry, but they're damn sight better than anything else we have.
Mama Kay smiled. He was underplaying his men's capabilities. She'd seen those men shoot.
What about your rent girls? This mission would cost lives. Are they ready for that?
You would have been amazed if you could have seen their faces, Brunt. It was like I gave them their souls back. They'd been dying inside, and now they've come back to life, all at once.
No word yet from Jarl?
There wouldn't be. Not yet.
Mama Kay put her hands on the rail and accidentally brushed his fingers. Brant looked at her hand, and then in her eyes, and quickly away. She winced and pulled her hand away. Decades ago, Agon had been arrogant. Not obnoxious with it, but merely full of youthful confidence that he could do pretty much anything better than pretty much anyone else. That was gone now, replaced by a sober understanding of his own strengths and weaknesses. He was a man well-tempered by the years. Guinevere had known men ruined by their wives, small women who felt so threatened they undercut their husbands for so many years that those men no longer trusted themselves. Such women had made Mama Kay wealthy. She knew men with perfectly good wives who were regulars, men addicted to the brothels as others were addicted to wine, but much of her business came from men desperate to be considered manly, strong, good lovers, noble. It was one of the many ironies of the business that they came to a brothel for that. Men, Mama Kay believed, were too simple to ever be truly safe from the temptations of a house of pleasure. It had been her business to make sure those temptations were multifaceted, and she'd been good at her business. Her establishments weren't just whorehouses. She had meeting rooms, smoking rooms, dignified parlors, lectures on all the topics men love. The food and drink were always finer than her competitors and priced lower. At her best establishments, she brought in chefs and wine masters from all over Mid-Kiru. As a restaurateur, she would have been a dismal failure. The food side of her business operated at a loss every year. But at her houses, men who came for the food stayed to spend their coin other ways. The few Brant Agons of the world didn't bang her girls for two reasons. They were happy at home, and they didn't walk through the doors in the first place. She was sure Agon had been derided for that. Men who didn't frequent the houses of pleasure were always mocked by those who did. Brant had conviction, integrity. He reminded her of Durzo. The thought sent a lance through her stomach. Durzo had been dead 3 months. Gods, how she missed him. She'd been helplessly in love with Durzo. Durzo was the only man in her life who would ever understand her. She'd been too terrified of that to let love grow. She'd been a coward. She'd starved their relationship of honesty, and like a plant potted in a shallow bowl, the relationship had been stunted. Durzo was the father of her child. He'd only found out a few days before he died. Mama Kay was 50 now, almost 51. The years had been kind to her, at least most days they seemed so. She usually looked 15 years younger than she was. Well, at least 10. If she tried, she thought she still had what it would take to seduce Brant.
Once a whore, always a whore, huh, Gwyn?
She used to despise old women who clung to their lost youth by their lacquered fingernails. Now, she was one. Part of her wanted to seduce Brant just to prove to herself that she still could. But she didn't want to seduce Brant. It had been years since she'd taken a man to her bed. For all the thousands of times it had been work, there had been times she'd liked or admired her lover of the moment. And there had been Durzo. The night they conceived Yuli, he'd been so blasted on mushrooms that he hadn't been much of a lover. But to have the man she loved share her bed had filled her to overflowing. She was so shot through with love and grief that she'd wept during their lovemaking. Even in his drugged state, Durzo had stopped and asked if he was hurting her. After that, it had taken all her skill to bring him to completion. Durzo had been a tender man when it came to taking his pleasure. Now their child was being raised by Kyler and Aline. It was the only deception she didn't regret. With those two, Yuli would do well. But she was tired of deceit, tired of taking and never giving. She didn't want to seduce Brandt. She knew he wanted her, and his wife was probably dead. Probably. But he couldn't know. Wouldn't know. Ever. How long would a man like Brandt Agon wait for the woman he loved?
Forever. That's the kind of man he is.
30-some years ago, they'd met at a party. Her first ever at a noble's home. He'd fallen instantly in love with her, and she'd allowed him to court her, never telling him what she did, what she was. He'd been gallant, confident, determined to make his mark on the world, and so sweetly careful in his courting that he hadn't asked her for a kiss for a month. She'd indulged in the fantasy. He would marry her, take her away from all the horrors she wanted so desperately to leave behind. She hadn't had that many noble clients yet. It was possible, wasn't it? The night of their first kiss, a noble had referred to her as the sweetest harlot he'd ever had. Brandt overheard it, instantly challenged the man to a duel, and killed him. Guinevere had fled. The next day, Brandt learned the truth. He enlisted and tried to get himself honorably killed fighting on the Curran border. But Brandt Agon had been too capable to die. Eventually, despite how he despised bootlicking and politicking, his merit had pulled him through the ranks. He married a plain woman from a merchant family. By all accounts, it was a happy marriage.
How long will it take to get everything ready?
Gwyn.
Yes?
I've loved you for years, Gwyn. Even after...
my betrayal?
Your indiscretion. You were what? 16? 17? You deceived yourself first, and I think you suffered for it more than I did.
Oh.
Regardless, I bear you no ill will. You are a beautiful woman, Gwyn. More beautiful than my Liza ever was. You are so brilliant that I feel I have to sprint just to keep up with you jogging. I've felt quite the opposite with Liza. You affect me profoundly.
But...
yes, but... I love Liza. And she has loved me through a thousand trials. And she deserves all that I have to give. Whether or not you have tender feelings for me, while I have hope that my Liza lives, I would ask... beg... that you would help me remain true to her.
You've chosen a hard road.
Not a road, a battle. Sometimes life is our battlefield. We must do what we know to do, not what we want to do.
Oh, thank you. So, how long till they're ready?
3 days.
Then let us make the night run red.
Solon dropped the two leather 500-weight bags he carried and grabbed Dorian as the prophet tottered.
What are you talking about?
Dorian pushed Solon's steadying arm away. He put on his cloak and sword belt and picked up two pairs of manacles.
This way.
Dorian grabbed one of the bags from Solon and headed down the open road away from the wall. The land leading to the wall was rocky, barren ground. It had been cleared of trees out to 150 yards. And though the road was broad enough for 20 men abreast, it was rutted and pitted from the wear of many feet and wagons over ground that alternated between soil and solid rock.
Kali is coming. I gave up my prophetic gift in case she captures me.
Solon couldn't even answer. Dorian stopped beneath a black oak that grew on a rocky outcropping that hung over the road.
She's here, not half a league away. It'll have to do. Make sure you only step on rock. If they see tracks, they'll find me.
Solon didn't move. Dorian had finally gone crazy. The other times it had been obvious. He'd simply been catatonic. But now, he seemed so rational.
Come on, Dorian, let's go back to the wall. We can talk about this in the morning.
The wall won't be there in the morning. Kali will strike at the witching hour. That gives you 5 hours to get the men out of there.
Dorian hoisted himself up on the ledge.
Throw the bags to me!
Kali, Dorian, she's a myth. You're trying to tell me that a goddess is half a league from here?
Not a goddess. Perhaps one of the rebel angels expelled from heaven and given leave to walk the earth until the end of days.
Right. I suppose she brought a dragon. We can talk about this.
Dragons avoid angels. Are you going to abandon me now when I need you? Have I ever lied to you? You thought Kurak was a myth too before we found it. I need you. When Kali comes through the wall, I'll go out of my mind. You've seen me when I thought I could use the Vir for good. That was like one part wine and 10 parts water. This is pure liquor. I will be lost. Her very presence brings out the worst. The worst fears, the worst memories, the worst sins. My hubris will come out. I might try to fight her and I'll lose. Or my lust for power will break me and I'll join her. She knows me. She will break me.
What if you're wrong? What if it is the madness you've warned about for so long?
If the wall stands at dawn, you'll know.
Solon threw the bags up to Dorian and then climbed carefully up the rock, making sure he didn't leave so much as a footprint. Dorian poured the gold onto the ground. Next, Dorian pulled on the manacles and the iron chains holding them together tore apart as if they were made of paper. He dropped a manacle onto the pile of coins, and it fell into the coins as if they were liquid. The other three manacles followed, and the piles of coins shrank each time. Dorian reached through the gold and pulled out each of the manacles, now sheathed in gold, and placed one on each of his wrists. He stretched the iron of the second pair and locked those manacles around his thighs, just above the knee. It was amazing. Dorian had always said that his power with the Vir had dwarfed his talent. Yet here he was, molding gold and iron artfully and effortlessly. In another moment, Dorian had shaped the rest of the coins into 4 narrow spikes and what looked like a bowl. He stopped, and now he concentrated. Solon could feel the brush of spells flowing past him, sinking into the metal.
There will be a contingent with her, the Soul Sworn. They've given up much of what is to become human to serve Kali, but they aren't the danger she is. Solon, I don't think you can defeat her. I think you should take the men away from here. Take them somewhere where their death might accomplish something. But if she makes it to Cenaria, Geralt Urzul's son will make 2 Ferali. They will use them on the resistance. This I have seen.
You didn't really do it, did you? You didn't really destroy your gift.
If I don't see you again, my friend, may the god go with you.
Dorian fused the gold spikes to the manacles and knelt behind the tree. He slid the spikes into the wood with unnatural ease.
What does all this do?
Solon picked up what had been a gold bowl. Now it was something between a helmet and a mask. It would fit completely over Dorian's head, with only 2 small holes in the nose for breathing. He turned it over. It was a perfect sculpture of Dorian's face, weeping tears of gold.
It will keep me from seeing her, from hearing her, from shouting out to her, from moving from this place. It will keep me from indulging in the last temptation, believing myself strong enough to fight her. I hope it will also keep me from using the Vir. But I can't bind myself magically. I need you to do it for me. After she's passed, I'll be able to escape when the sun rises and refills my talent, so you needn't worry for me. If you need your gold, it will be here.
You're leaving, no matter what.
Don't ask where.
Good luck.
You've been a brother to me, Solon. I believe we'll meet again before this is done. Now hurry.
Solon fit the gold helmet over Dorian's head and bound it with the strongest magic he could, completely emptying his Glorvirden to do it. He'd do no more magic until sunrise. It wasn't a comforting thought. As he climbed down from the rock outcropping, he swore that he saw bark growing over Dorian's arms where they otherwise would have been exposed. From the road, Dorian was invisible.
Goodbye, brother.
The God King perched on the fireglass throne he'd ordered cut from the rock of the maw. To him, the sharp-edged blackness was a reminder, a goad, and a comfort at once. His son stood before him. His first son, not just the seed of his loins. The God King spread his seed far and wide. He never considered the weeds that took hold to be sons. They were just bastards, and he gave them no thought. The only ones who mattered were the boys who would be Verdmeisters. The training, though, was more than most could survive. Only a few boys out of scores of Witchborn survived to become his Aethlings, his throne-worthy sons. Each of those had been given an Urdthun, a harrowing to prove his worth. So far, only Moburu had succeeded. Only Moburu would he acknowledge as his son, and still not yet his heir. The truth was, Moburu pained him. Gareth remembered the boy's mother, an island princess of some sort, captured in the days before the Sethi Empire had destroyed Gareth's attempt at a navy. He'd been intrigued by her, and while an endless procession of other women born high and low, willing and not, made its way through his bedchamber, he'd actually tried to seduce her. She'd been as passionate as he was calculating, as hot as he was cold. She'd been exotic, enticing. He'd tried everything except magic. He'd been certain with a young man's certainty that no woman could long resist him. After a year, she still held on to her haughty disdain. She despised him. One night, he'd lost his patience and raped her. He'd meant to have her strangled afterward, but was oddly ashamed. Later, Neff had told him the woman was pregnant. He'd put the child out of his mind until Neff told him the boy had survived the trials and was ready for his Urdthun. Gareth had given Moburu an Urdthun he'd been sure would be the death of him. But the man had completed that task as easily as every other Gareth had put before him. The worst part of all was that the heir presumptive to Kalidor's throne didn't even look Kalidoran. He had his mother's eyes, her throaty voice, and her skin. Her Ladeshian skin. It was a bitter gall. Why couldn't Dorian have made it? Gareth had held such high hopes for Dorian. He'd liked Dorian. Dorian had achieved his Urdthun and then had betrayed Gareth. Gareth had held lower hopes for the one who'd called himself Roth, but at least Roth looked Kalidoran. Moburu wore the regalia of an Alataran cavalry officer, red brocade on gold with a dragon's head seal. He was intelligent, quick-witted, utterly self-assured, roughly handsome despite his Ladeshian skin, Gareth grudgingly admitted, reputed to be one of the best riders in the cavalry, and ruthless, of course. He stood as a son of the God King should. He wore humility as naturally as a man wore a dress. It irked Gareth, but it was his own fault. He had designed his seed's lives so that those who survived would be exactly what Moburu was. His problem was that he'd designed all those tests to present him with candidates. He had hoped to have a number of sons. If he did, their attention would be fixed on each other. Brother would plot against brother for their father's favor. But now, with Dorian gone, Roth dead, and none of the others beyond their Urdthun, Moburu was alone. The man's ambition would force him to turn his eyes on the God King himself soon, if he hadn't already.
What news from the Freeze?
Your Holiness, it is as bad as we thought. Maybe worse. The clans have already sent out the summons. They've agreed to truces so they can winter close enough to the border to join the war band at spring. They're spawning Kroll and maybe Zell and Varali. If they've learned to do that, they'll be increasing their numbers for the next 9 months.
How did they find a spawning place in the Freeze, for Kali's sake, under the permafrost?
My lord, we can counteract that threat easily enough. I've taken the liberty of ordering Kali brought here. She'll come through Screaming Winds. It's faster.
You did what?
She'll massacre one of Sonaria's most formidable garrisons, saving you a headache. She'll arrive in a few days. Beneath this castle is perfect spawning ground. The locals call it the Maw. With Kali here, we can breed an army such as the world has never seen. This ground is steeped in misery. The caverns beneath Kaliras have been mined for 700 years. The Kroll, our Verdmeisters, can produce there, and nothing compared to what's possible here.
Son! Oh, son. You have never spawned a Kroll. You have never forged Ferali or bred Ferozi. You have no idea what it costs. There's a reason I used human armies to conquer the Highlanders and the River Clans and the Tronglong and the Grost. I've solidified our rule within and expanded our borders 4 times and never once used Kroll. Do you know how people fight when they know that if they lose, their entire families will be eaten? They fight to the last man. They arm their children with bows. Their women use kitchen knives and pokers. I saw it in my youth. And it gained my father nothing.
Your father didn't have the Veer. You do.
There's more to it than Veer. This conversation is over.
Maburu had never dared speak to him this way before, and ordering Kali brought here without asking. But Gareth was distracted. He had lied.
He had made Kroll Ferozi, and even Ferali.
Ferali had killed his last 2 brothers. He'd sworn then, never again.
Never again. With any of the monsters except for the few breeding pairs of Ferozi he'd been working on to someday send into the Iosian forest for Ezra's treasures.
But those he'd already paid for. They required nothing more of him. But Maburu might be right. That was the worst of it. He had gotten used to treating Maburu as a partner, a son in the way other fathers treated their sons. It had been a mistake. He'd shown indecision. Maburu was surely already plotting for his throne. Gareth could kill him, but Maburu was too valuable, a tool to throw away carelessly. Curse him. Why hadn't his brothers turned out? Maburu needed a rival.
I've changed my mind. Think out loud for me, son, and make your case.
I'd admit that our armies could probably counter the wild men from the Freeze. Even if the clans stayed together, our Verdmeisters would tip the balance in our favor. But to do that, we have to send every capable Meister north. Quite honestly, there wouldn't be a worse time. The sisters grow suspicious and frightened. Some of them are saying they need to fight us now before we grow any stronger. We know the Kurens will seize any weakness to come pouring over the border. They've wanted Cenaria for hundreds of years.
The Kurens are split.
There's a brilliant young general named Lantano Garawashi who's gathering a large following in northern Kura. He's never lost a duel or battle. If we send our armies and our Meisters north, attacking us could be just what he needs to unify Kura. Unlikely, but possible.
Go on.
The God King knew all about Lantano Garawashi, nor was he worried about the sisters. He'd personally arranged for their present political crisis.
It also seems the Sakage is much better established and more capably led than we had believed. It's obviously the work of the new Shenga, Jarl. I think it shows that he's moved into a new phase of...
Jarl is dead.
That can't be. I haven't found any sign.
Jarl has been dead for a week.
But there haven't even been rumors of that. And with the level of organizations we found... I don't understand.
You don't have to. Go on.
There are rumors that Shokendi is sending a delegation to investigate what they call the alleged Caladoran threat.
Your sources call it a delegation?
Yes. And if the mages decide we're a threat, they could return to Shokendi and come back with an army by spring.
Those delegates are battle mages. 6 full battle mages. The Sasuren believe that they found and lost a Jorzen Elkesti's sword, Kurok. They think it may be here in Cenaria.
How do you know that? My source sits just outside the High Sasuren itself.
Your brother told me. He's one of the delegates.
My brother?
Well, not a brother yet. Soon. I suppose you can guess his word, Thon. It is somewhat more difficult than your own.
He is to recover Kurok?
Gareth smiled his thin-lipped smile. He could see Maburu thinking. A son who recovered Kurok would be highly favored, highly powerful. Indeed, one of Gareth's ulcers had Kurok's name on it, If any of his sons recovered Kurok, that son might not hand it over. Kurok would give him enough power to challenge Gareth himself. Mabooru would think of that immediately. But Gareth already had plans for that. Many plans, from the most facile, bribes and blackmail, to the most desperate, a death spell that might throw his consciousness into the murderer's body. That was not a spell one could safely test, so the best thing was to keep the sword out of his son's hands.
But you have raised some excellent points, son. You have become valuable to me. I will grant your wish. You will build me a Ferrari.
Yes, your holiness.
Oh, and Mabooru, impress me.
You want us to flee, and you won't say why? Is that supposed to impress me?
Lord Voss looked utterly vexed.
300 soldiers had gathered in the dark courtyard, the moon a sliver in a night sky aflame with stars. 300 soldiers dressed for battle, bundled against the fierce cold that had already descended on these mountains, though summer's heat had barely lost its edge in Sonaria City. 300 soldiers and their commander, who wasn't Solon. 300 men who were watching the exchange between Solon and Leros Voss.
I admit that it sounds weak, but I only ask for a day. We leave for one day and then we come back. If I'm wrong, it's not like there are any looters who will have taken anything. We're the only people in these godforsaken mountains, aside from the Highlanders, and they haven't raided the wall in 3 years.
It's abandoning our post. We're sworn to hold this wall.
We have no post. We have no king. We have no lord. We have 300 men and an occupied country. Our oaths were to men now dead. Our duty is to keep these men alive so they can fight when we have a chance. This isn't the kind of war where we gloriously charge the enemy lines with our swords waving.
If you would have us leave, I demand to know why.
A contingent of Kalidorian elites known as the Soulsworn is coming. They're bringing the Kalidoran goddess Kali to Sonaria. They'll attack the wall at the witching hour.
And you want to leave? Do you know what it will mean when we capture the Kalidoran's goddess? It will destroy them. It will give our countrymen hope. We'll be heroes. This is the place to stop them. We have the walls, the traps, the men. This is our chance. This is just what we've been waiting for.
Son, this goddess, we're not talking about capturing a statue. I think she's real.
If you need to run away, you go ahead. You know where the road is. Of course, I can't let you go until you give me my gold back.
If Solon told him where his gold was now, Voss would have his men go get it immediately. Dorian would be left helpless.
To hell with you, and to hell with me too. We'll die together.
Sister Ariel Wyant sat 5 paces from the first magical boundary that separated the Iosian forest from the oak grove. For the past 6 days, she'd had her eye on what appeared to be a plaque 20 feet inside the forest. It didn't look like it had been there long. Undergrowth hadn't covered it yet. Her first hope, in all her examinations of the ward, had been that Ezra had made the ward hundreds of years ago. With other mages, she would have expected the weaves to disintegrate after so much time. Weaves always disintegrated. But with Ezra, always didn't mean always. The proof shimmered just beyond mundane sight before her. The second hope was that, given Ezra's power and the power of the other magi of his era, he would be defending himself against opponents far more powerful than any alive today. Sister Ariel didn't have the arrogance to think herself equal to those Ezra would have expected. She could only hope that her light touches against the weaves would be beneath notice. Termites were tiny, but they'd destroyed many a mighty house. So for 6 days, she'd examined and re-examined the weaves that divided the Iosian forest from the oak grove. It was as beautiful as a black widow's web. There were traps both large and small. There were weaves that were meant to tear apart with the faintest touch, weaves that were meant to be unraveled, weaves that couldn't be broken with double Ariel's strength, and each had a trap. Ariel could guess exactly what Sister Jessie had done. She probably tried to conceal talent. For the first day, it looked like a perfect strategy. It was a strategy that would have worked had Ezra been simple. Sister Jessie was weak enough that she could compress her talent and then shield it. That would make her talent invisible to other sisters or to male seers. Now there was a strange thought. How many times had talented women used exactly that strategy to hide themselves or their talented daughters from sisters who came to recruit from the Chantry? Ariel shook her head. It wasn't time to get distracted. The problem was that Ezra's weave didn't just register talent. As nearly as Ariel could tell, and she had to guess because of the complexity and delicacy of the weaves, Ezra's weaves detected mages' bodies. Everyone knew that mages were different from regular people, but not even healers today understood exactly how magic changed a mage's flesh. That it did so was undeniable. Mages aged differently, sometimes more slowly the more talented they were, but sometimes not. Regardless, their very flesh was altered in subtle ways by their constant interactions with magic. Apparently, Ezra knew exactly what those ways were. Sister Ariel should have guessed that. Among no few other achievements, he had been a Sa-Salar, a lord of healing. He had created the Dark Hunter, created a living being.
Oh, Sister Jessie, did you walk right through this wall of magic? Did you really think yourself cleverer than Ezra himself? How many mages' bones litter this damned forest?
She was letting her mind get off the problem at hand. She was still alive. She had made it past the first barrier. Now she needed to do something with that accomplishment. She needed to get that damned gold plaque. It was stuck, 20 feet away, just at the top of a small hillock. It was so close, and yet she had no hope of getting it. Her examination of Ezra's traps had left her convinced of it. It would take her years to dismantle his traps. Years, if ever. Even if she had the time, she would never be sure that she hadn't missed something. She could never be sure how many other layers of protection were left. Ezra might have spun this ward in a few days. He might have intended that this layer be penetrated by weak mages. Sister Ariel could spend her whole life dismantling traps and never uncover Ezra's real secrets. If she'd come here as a younger woman, she might have thought it a worthy use of her life. But as a younger woman, she'd been much more idealistic. She'd believed in the Chantry with the kind of foolish faith that most people reserve for their religion. If Ezra did possess devastatingly powerful artifacts, would Ariel really want to deliver those to the Speaker? Would she trust Istariel with something that would multiply her power 10 times?
Stop it, Ariel. You're letting your mind wander again.
She looked at the plaque. Then she started laughing. It was so simple. She stood and started walking back to the village. She returned an hour later with a full stomach and a rope. Master Zorlat had been kind enough to show her how to make and throw a lasso. For the last 2 days, she'd wondered how to get the plaque, and for 2 days, she'd thought of only magical means. Stupid. The next several hours proved her clumsy as well. How many times in her life had she sneered at the men who worked the Chantry stables? This was the kind of exercise every sister should be exposed to, in front of all the stable hands in the Chantry. When the lasso finally dropped around the plaque, she could swear the gold glowed briefly. She wanted to extend her senses to see what had just happened, but it was too far away. She decided there was nothing to do but pull the damned thing in. At first, the plaque wouldn't move. It was somehow stuck. Then, as Ariel pulled, part of the hillock shifted and rolled over, freeing the plaque. It wasn't a hillock. It was Sister Jessie's body. She'd been dead for weeks. Mold grew over her bright robes, obscuring the bloodstains. It looked like a claw had torn away half of her head in a single terrible swipe. Since her death, no animals had disturbed her body. There were no bears or coyotes or ravens or other carrion feeders in Ezra's wood, but the worms were well into their work. Sister Aria looked away, allowing herself a moment to be a woman confronting an acquaintance's mutilated body. She was glad that Jesse's body was as far away as it was. She'd been this close for days, and she'd never even smelled decay. Was that a trick of the wind, or magic? The plaque had been clutched in Sister Jesse's hands. Sister Ariel carefully walled up all the emotions she felt and set them aside. She would examine them later, allow herself tears if tears must come. For now, she might be in danger. She looked at the plaque. It was too far away to tell what symbols, if any, were on its surface, but there was something about it that chilled her to the bone. The square plaque had hooks embedded in the rope. They looked as if they had formed when the lasso had landed to help her pull it out. She pulled the plaque close to the ward, but kept it on the far side. There was no telling what pulling something that might be magical through the barrier would do. The script was Gemitic, but Ariel found she remembered it surprisingly well.
If this is the fourth day, take your time. If it's the seventh, pull this through the ward now.
The runes went on, but Ariel stopped and scowled. It wasn't at all the sort of thing someone would usually write on a plaque. She wondered to whom the words could possibly have been addressed. Perhaps this plaque had been part of some ancient test, a rite of passage for mages. How had Sister Jesse interpreted it? Why had she thought it was so important?
Days at the ward horse face. You're a lousy throw, by the way.
Ariel dropped the rope from nerveless fingers. She'd been called Horseface when she was a Tyro. She tried to translate the words another way, but the Gemitic runes made it clear that it was a personal name, a specific insult, not generic. Looking at the way the plaque had caught on the rope now, she was suddenly sure that it had grabbed the rope, as if it was sentient. The hooks weren't equally placed on opposite sides of the plaque. Instead, it was as if they had grown in response to the lasso's touch. The plaque glowed, and Sister Ariel stumbled backward in fright. It was a mistake. She scrambled to her feet as quickly as her fat limbs would lift her. The plaque was no longer glowing. She picked it up.
Prophecy.
The Gemitic runes dissolved into common as she touched the plaque.
Not sentience.
The script continued to appear before her as if written by an invisible quill.
If this is the seventh day, look two stadia south, stadia.
Perhaps units of measure didn't translate. How far was two stadia? 300 paces? 400? Fear paralyzed Sister Ariel. She'd never been the type for adventures. She was a scholar, and a damned good one. She was one of the more powerful sisters, but she didn't like charging into things she didn't understand. She turned the plaque over.
Wards in trees.
Jesse L. Gwaden had written in a panicked hand.
Don't trust him. Oh, perfect.
Sister Ariel was rooted to the ground. The words Sister Jesse had written could only have been written with magic. Surely Sister Jesse wouldn't have used magic inside the wood. It would have been suicide.
She is dead.
It could all be a trap. The plaque might have triggered something as it was pulled through the ward. There might be a trap in the trees to the south where the plaque was trying to get her to go. Maybe she should go write down everything, ignore the trap, play by her own rules. But Sister Ariel didn't go back to Taurus Bend to write in her journal. She'd studied the ward to the south. If there had been a trap, she'd already triggered it. There was a time and a place for haste. Apparently, that was now and here.
So, you're kind of a pain in the ass. Why'd Kyler take you in?
They'd been on the trail for a week, and if Yuli wasn't the best company, at least she was more interesting than the horses and the trees and the little villages they had to avoid. He wasn't making conversation. She was gathering much information. Kyler was coming to kill her.
He did it because he loves me. Someday he's going to marry me.
Yes, yes, I know. But he couldn't have loved you before he knew you, could he? You said that when he took you out of the castle was the first time you saw him?
I thought he was my real father at first.
Who are your real parents?
My father's name is Durzo, but he's dead now. Kinda won't talk about him. I think my mother is Mama Kay. She always looked at me funny when we stayed with her.
V had to grab the back of her saddle to steady herself. Nisos, that was it. She knew Yuli looked familiar. Yuli was Durzo and Mama Kay's daughter. No wonder they'd concealed her. It also explained why Kyler had taken her in. Inexplicably, the thought made her ache. She couldn't imagine taking in one of Hugh's bastards. For that matter, she couldn't imagine Hugh caring about one of them. Suddenly, Yuli was twice as valuable to the God King. Holding Yuli would mean controlling Mama Kay. Maybe it would be enough to free V from his clutches. But V knew better. The God King rewarded his servants well. Any vice she had, she would be allowed to indulge to satiety. He'd give her gold, clothes, slaves, whatever she wanted. But he'd never give her freedom. She'd proven herself too valuable for that. The more V learned about Kyler, the more she despaired. She needed Yuli to talk because she needed to know everything about her enemy she could. Everything she learned was from a 12-year-old girl who had a crush on the man. But V was good at sifting truth from opinion. Still, Kyler was sounding more and more...
Fuck!
She wasn't going to think about that again. It just left her feeling worse. Damn this trail. Damn this long trip. One more week and she could wash her hands of this. Maybe she wouldn't even stick around for her payday, much as she deserved it. She'd drop off the girl with a note about what she'd done, and she'd disappear. She'd killed Jarl. She'd deliver Kyler and Mama Kay to the God King. Surely he wouldn't waste his resources sending someone after her then. Even if he did, he wouldn't come after her with the fury he would have if she betrayed him. She could disappear. There were only a few people she feared, and all of them were too valuable to be sent after her. One of them was Kyler, but he wouldn't survive long. Maybe he'd killed Roth Ursul, 38 Highlanders and some witches. Yuli seemed to know a lot about that. But he'd never survive the God King. V would head to Seth or Ladesh or deep into the mountains of Kura, where her red hair wouldn't be so unusual. She'd never spread her legs for another man, and she'd never take another contract. She didn't know what a normal life looked like, but she'd give herself time to figure it out. After this. She pulled the scrap of note she'd taken from Kyler's house and read it again.
Aline, I'm sorry. I tried. I swear I tried. Some things are worth more than my happiness. Some things only I can do. Sell these to Master Barari and move the family to a better part of town. I will always love you.
Hey, Ugly. What did Aline and Kyler fight about?
I think it was about how the bed wasn't creaking.
Well, that's normal enough. Was that all?
Why? What's it mean?
Fucking. Men and women fight about it all the time.
What's fucking?
So V told her as explicitly as possible, and Yuli looked more and more horrified.
Does it hurt?
Sometimes.
It sounds gross.
It is. It's messy and sticky and sweaty and smelly and gross. Sometimes it even makes you bleed.
Ugh, why do girls let them do that?
Because men make them. That's why they fight about it.
Kyler wouldn't do that. He wouldn't hurt Aline.
Then why'd they fight about it?
He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't. I don't think they ever did it anyway. Because the bed never creaked and Aunt Mia said it would. But Aunt Mia said it was fun.
Whatever. Is that all they fought about?
She wanted him to sell his sword. The sword Durzo gave him. He didn't want to. But she said it proved he still wanted to be a wet boy. But he didn't. He really wanted to be with us. It made him really mad when she said that.
So he wanted out too. That's what he meant in the note when he said he tried. He tried to leave.
Nice.
Kyler might not even know she'd taken Yuli. She didn't know if that was a good thing or not. It did explain why he'd gone charging past them in the fog that morning, though. He would have been sure she'd return to Sonaria as quickly as possible. Several hundred paces ahead, V saw the forest change. No, not change. It transformed as abruptly as if the earth had been split with an axe. On the near side, the forest was like what they'd been riding in for days. On the far side, enormous sequoias grew. They must be near Taurus Bend. It didn't mean much to her, but it looked like the riding would be easier under those great trees. There was almost no undergrowth in a forest that old. They were only 50 paces from the sequoias when an old woman stepped out from the trees in front and to one side of them. She looked as startled as V felt. She was holding a glowing sheet of gold in her hands. Glowing gold could only mean magic. The woman was a mage.
Stop!
V snapped her body back in the saddle and yanked the reins of Yuli's horse out of her hands. As she sat back up, she jabbed her heels in and looked toward the mage. The woman was running heavily, awkwardly, and not toward V and Yuli. She was running away from the old forest, and she had flung aside the glowing gold sheet. What the hell? It was strange, but not so strange that V stopped. In all the world, the only people she had to fear were wet boys, witches, and mages. The horses charged for the forest, almost throwing Yuli out of the saddle. The mage was only 30 paces away now, almost even with him. She ran a few more steps, and V could have sworn that the woman was emerging from something like a vast, nearly invisible bubble covering the forest. The woman brought up her hands.
Ulmator Canus!
V dropped her body as far on the opposite side of the horse as she could. Yuli flew off the horse. There was no hesitation. A wet boy doesn't hesitate. A wet boy acts, even if it's the wrong action. V couldn't stay still. It made her a target. She dug her heels into her horse's flanks again. The horse lunged forward and promptly crashed into the ground, its front legs cut out from under it. V slapped into the ground hard, her body flipping over as she skidded on her back. Her head kissed an iron-hard root, and black spots swarmed before her eye. V got on her hands and knees and tried to stand.
I'm sorry. I can't let you do that. Arias Vulcor!
It was two small cuts, a line along the ribs, and a matching line across the inside of his arm. Neither was deep. The knife had cut skin, but not muscle. Even together, they were nothing. A clean bandage and some fresh air wouldn't have seen heal in a few days. But in the hole, nothing was clean. Fresh air was only a memory. Logan recognized the signs, but there was nothing he could do. He was hot and cold already, shivering and sweating. The odds were he wouldn't come out of the fever. After all the time he'd spent in the hole, he was a shadow of his former self. Cheeks sunken, eyes bright, face skeletal, his tall frame now skin and bone. If he survived, he could get worse yet, he knew. For all that he'd starved, Logan still didn't have the malnourished, emaciated look that those who had been in the hole for years had. His body was clinging to its strength with a stubbornness that surprised him. But the fever cared nothing for that. It would take days at the least to fight off the fever. Days of total vulnerability.
Natasa, tell me again about the resistance.
The younger Grayson daughter had a haunted look in her eyes. She didn't respond. She was looking across the hole at Finn, who was gnawing on sinews to add to his rope.
Natasha!
They move around. There are a number of estates that welcome them in the east, especially the Gyres. Even the Lycanoct have helped.
Bastards.
Bastards who are our enemy's enemy.
And our numbers are growing?
Our numbers are growing. We've been conducting raids. Small groups. Going and doing anything they can to hurt the Kalidorians. But my sister wouldn't let us try anything big yet. Count Drake has set up informants for us in every village in Eastern Cenaria.
Count Drake? Wait, I asked that before, didn't I?
She didn't respond. Her eyes were still on Finn. Finn had killed four of the newcomers in the last 3 days. 3 days? Or was it four now? Count Drake was part of the resistance. That was great. Logan hadn't known if the man had made it out alive.
I'm glad Kyla didn't kill him, too.
Who?
Count Drake. He betrayed me. He's the reason I'm down here.
Count Drake betrayed you?
No, Kyla. Dressed all in black. Called himself the Night Angel.
Kyler Stern is the Night Angel.
He was working for Kalidor all along.
No, he wasn't. The Night Angel's the only reason there's a resistance at all. I was there. We were all herded into the garden and he saved us. Terra offered him whatever he wanted to escort us out of the castle. But he only cared about you. He left us to try to save you, Logan.
But he killed Prince Elaine. He was the one who started all this.
Lady Jadwin killed Elaine Gunder. She's been given a portion of his estates as her reward.
It didn't seem possible. After everything had been stripped away from him, Natasa was giving him back his best friend. He missed Kyla so much.
And Sarah Drake? Was she with you too? She's part of the resistance? Kyla saved her?
She's dead.
Did she suffer?
Natasa looked down.
Sarah.
His fiancée not so long ago. She seemed part of another life, another world. He had loved her once, or thought he loved her. How could he have loved her when she'd barely crossed his mind in all the time he'd been down here? She'd betrayed him. She'd slept with his best friend, Prince Elaine Gunder, when she had never even slept with him, the man she said she loved. Had that been it? Had that betrayal extinguished his feelings for her? Or had he ever loved her at all? He thought that he was finally understanding love on his wedding night.
Everyone who is infatuated thinks he understands love.
But Logan couldn't help it. What he'd felt for Janine Gunder, the 15-year-old girl he'd been so sure was too young and immature for him, had seemed like love. Maybe he'd been snatched away before he'd had time to see her flaws, but Janine Gunder, Janine Geyer, his wife, if only for a few tragic hours, was the woman who had haunted his thoughts. He dreamed of her in the moments before sleep yielded to the hard stone and cruel stink and howling and heat of the hole. Her full smile, her bright eyes, her golden curves in candlelight, as he had seen her just once, so briefly, before the Kalidoran soldiers had broken into the room, before Roth had cut her throat.
God.
Everything was fuzzy and getting fuzzier. He had held off grief for so long, but he couldn't do it anymore.
I'll be with you soon.
That's what he had told Janine. It was true now. He was going to die here. He already was dying. He looked at Natasa's face and she was weeping with him. The poor girl. She'd been captured, betrayed by someone in the resistance, and put down here with these monsters. Logan didn't know how much she wept for him and how much she wept for herself. He didn't blame her. She had to know that once he was gone, the Holers would take her. Even Lily was crying. He wouldn't have imagined she was capable of it. Why was she crying? Was she afraid that once the Holers had Natasa, who was younger and prettier, that she'd lose her power and her position? That she would be killed? Looking at Lily's face, Logan hated himself for the cynicism of that thought. He'd been down here too long. The look on her face wasn't fear. It was love. Lily wasn't weeping for herself. She was weeping for him.
Who am I to deserve such devotion? I'm not worthy of this. Help me up.
Lily looked at Natasha, and her tears ceased. Everyone in the hole was looking at Logan now. Some with curiosity, some with hunger. Finn looked positively jubilant.
All right, you fucks. Listen up. I've kept a little secret from you because I didn't know what fine, upstanding felons you all are. I've kept a little secret that might make a big difference.
Yeah, we know. Our little king thinks he's Logan Goya. He thinks he really is the king.
Finn, there's two good reasons for you to shut your shithole. First, I'm dying. I've got nothing to lose. But if you keep that tooth-filled anus of yours shut, I'll die, and you won't have to do a damn thing. But if you keep talking, I'll come kill you. I might be weak, but I'm strong enough to drag your poxy asshole down the hole if I don't mind falling in myself. Believe me, if we start fighting, there's more than one person down here who will make sure we both go in.
And the second reason...
If you don't shut up, it'll be your fault that I threw this down the hole.
Logan reached inside his belt and pulled out an iron key.
It's the key to the grave.
The holers started pressing closer, and Logan staggered toward the hole. He held the key out over the darkness and swayed back and forth in not completely feigned dizziness.
I'm feeling real sick, real dizzy. So if you all want this key to go in its little home up there, you'll listen real close.
How could you have held onto it all this time? We could have escaped months ago.
Shut up, Nick!
Logan looked around, trying to see where the greasy Caladoran Duke was, but the faces were a blur.
If we want to use this key, we have to work together. Do you all understand? If one person does the wrong thing, we all die. And the worst thing is, we have to trust each other. It will take three of us to reach the lock. We do this my way, or I throw away the key. If we do this my way, we all get out. Understand? Even you, Finn. Once we get up into the moor, I have a plan that will get at least half of us out. Maybe all of us. They've been doing construction at the other end of this tunnel. And I think I can use that, as long as we kill Gorky before he raises the alarm. But you all have to do exactly what I say.
He's crazy.
It's our only chance. I'm in.
Everyone looked at Tats in wonder. It was the first time anyone had heard the tattooed Lord Drukhari speak.
Good. Now we need three people to make a tower to reach the gate. Nasha will be the base... I'll be the second, and Lily will unlock the gate. From there, we've got two options, and which one we choose is up to Finn.
Finn looked even more suspicious.
First option. All of you who are light enough and strong enough to climb up the three of us can get out. But I won't let Finn climb out. So me and Nasha and Finn will die.
Anyone's going... I'm going. You're not...
Shut the fuck up, Finn!
Second option. Finn gives Lily his rope. She can tie it to something up there, and we all climb out. Finn, it's your rope, so it's your choice. Oh, and if I don't get out, I'm not telling you my plan to get out of the mall.
Everyone looked at Finn.
You can use a rope, but if you want to use my rope, I'm going to be part of the tower. I'll open the grate.
Forget it. No one here trusts you. If you get out, you'll leave us.
Well, I'm not climbing up that toothy freak. You want my rope? I want to be part of the tower, and that's final.
Fine. I'll be the base. You be the second. Lily opens the grate.
Logan handed her the key.
Lily, Finn tries anything, you throw that key down the hole, got it?
If anyone tries anything, I throw the key down the hole. I swear by all the gods of hell and pain and the hole.
We do this one at a time. I'll tell you who goes next.
Logan drew the knife and handed it to Natasa.
Natasa, anyone who comes close before their turn, you stick them with this, all right? Natasa will be the first out. She'll tie the rope to something up there so we can all climb out. Finn and me will be last. But everyone's going to get out. We've paid for our crimes.
Finn walked around the hole, uncoiling the sinew rope from around his body. He rolled it into big loops with an almost frightening ease. He claimed to have strangled 30 people before he was caught, not counting islanders and women. Underneath the ropes, he looked like anyone who'd been in the hole for a long time. Scrawny, skin deep brown with dirt, reeking, his mouth bloody, sometimes from the scurvy that every long-time holer suffered. He stepped close to Logan.
We'll settle us later.
Finn took the coiled rope and settled it around his neck. Logan wiped the sweat off his brow. He wanted to kill the man now. If he grabbed the rope and shoved, maybe. It wasn't worth the risk. He was too weak, too slow now. He should have tried this plan earlier. But earlier, Finn would never have come this close to him. Finn would have expected Logan to try to kill him any other time, and before Logan had regained the knife, trying it would have made him too vulnerable. Bracing himself against the wall with his hands, Logan squatted. Finn edged close to him, sneering.
Fucking bugger's probably trying to sneak a pick at me bits all the time I'm above him.
He finally put a foot on Logan's thigh, stepped onto his back, and then up onto his shoulders, walking his own hands up the sheer wall. Surprisingly, the weight wasn't that bad. Logan thought he could make it. He just had to lock his knees and lean on the wall, and he could make it. There was no way he'd be able to climb up the rope on his own strength, but maybe his friends would pull him out. If he went out last, he'd tie the rope around himself, and Lily and Nash and Natasa could pull him out.
Hurry!
You're too damn tall! Can you squat down?
Logan shook his head.
Shit. Fine. Ask Nash her to help. You're the only one he listens to.
Ask him what?
To lift me!
Oh! Nash, pick her up!
Nasty, a big bird!
No, Nash, not like that!
It took some coaching, but finally Nash understood and squatted beside Logan while Lily climbed up onto his back and then stood on his shoulders. Then she put the key in her teeth and started trying to transfer over. Logan was much taller than Nasher, so Lily had to step up onto Logan's shoulder, where Finn was already standing. The uneven weight made Logan sway.
Ah, stay still, you stupid fucking twist!
Natasa put a hand on Logan's shoulder, trying to brace him. Logan felt cold wash over him.
Just hurry!
Lily's weight pressed down again on his left shoulder. Then weight shifted back and forth above him as she and Finn tried to balance. Logan couldn't tell what they were doing. He squeezed his eyes shut and held on to the wall.
You can do this! You can do this!
The weight shifted suddenly, hard to the right. Logan sagged and then fought, his right leg shaking with the exertion. The burden suddenly lightened. Logan squinted up and saw that Lily was on Finn's back, and she had grabbed the grate above her with one hand, stabilizing herself and taking some of her weight.
Oh, where are all my little puppets? How I do so love to fuck your world over.
They all knew whose voice that was. Gorky was coming.